at 9:02 a.m. Yet the Northeast Air Defense Sector of NORAD was fully staffed on 9/11, and the entire staff, even when placed on high alert, remained oblivious of the third jetliner that crashed into the Pentagon at 9:37 a.m., and that the fourth jetliner, which, thanks to heroic passengers, crashed in Shanksville, was headed toward the White House. Procedures at NORAD were completely abandoned. There were 15- to 20-minute delays in issuing warnings to air traffic controllers. Interceptor planes were not scrambled by NORAD from the bases near the targets, even when it was clear that the commandeered jets were headed toward Manhattan and Washington, D.C., and fighter planes that were in the air were not redeployed by NORAD to prevent the attacks. This mystery of the prevention of interceptions is intensified by the fact that the air traffic controllers on duty that day in New York recorded a tape of all that had transpired before, during, and after the attacks. But the tape, which included vital testimony, was seized by a Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, quality assurance manager, who crushed the tape in his hand and cut it into tiny pieces, which he proceeded to deposit in different trash containers. Kenneth Meade, the FAA Inspector General, said that the destruction of the tape was merely a matter of poor judgment. The stand-down order to NORAD had come from Vice President Dick Cheney, who was safe and secure within a bunker beneath the White House. This fact was confirmed by Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation. Cheney was a director of the CFR and a former executive of Halliburton, one of America's largest defense contractors, who had given Cheney a $34 million signing bonus to serve as George W. Bush's running mate. What accounts for such bizarre action? Why was this crucial tape seized and destroyed? Why had NORAD failed to respond to a prolonged attack in such strategic locations? The answer, in part, resides from the fact that NORAD had received a stand-down order that its commanders were compelled to obey. The order came from Vice President Dick Cheney, who had sought shelter from the attacks in a bunker. Mystery number 3. The missing rubble. Another mystery lies with the rubble, including the debris from the planes that was removed from Ground Zero before it could be examined by forensic experts. The Twin Towers collapsed in a manner identical with a planned implosion. Such an implosion would have required the use of pyrotechnic substances, traces of which would have remained among the mounds of twisted steel. Yet 185,100 tons of structural steel that should have been subjected to detailed analysis were loaded on trucks and transported to salvage yards in New Jersey, where the steel was cut into fragments for recycling. A substantial amount of this recycled steel was sold at the rock-bottom price of $120 per ton and shipped off to China. Given that the removal and recycling of World Trade Center steel took place over the objections of victims' families and others seeking a genuine investigation, many uttered a sigh of relief when news was announced that steel parts of the Twin Towers had been saved from the smelting furnaces. The heaviest of these steel pieces was stored in an 80,000-square-foot hangar at John F. Kennedy International Airport. These pieces included some of the base sections of the tower's massive core columns and 13 of the 153 steel trees from the bases of the tower's perimeter walls. Although the hangar, which reportedly held 1/500th of the total debris field, remained off-limits to the public, the discovery of the existence of intact pieces of the Twin Towers' columns seemed to be good news for independent investigators who would like to test samples of steel. However, the locations of these pieces within the towers belied reason for their preservation. The large core column sections stood on the tower's foundations, 7 stories below street level, and the perimeter column trees were from the lobby level, just above street level. Only these lower sections of the towers were spared the blasting that shredded the steel frames down to about their 4 stories. This was evident from the facts that 18 people survived in the lower reaches of the North Tower's core, and fragments of the perimeter walls of each tower remained standing after the buildings collapsed. Mystery 4. The Insider Trading. Among the mysteries is the finding that an elite group of Wall Street investors purportedly possessed criminal foreknowledge of 9/11, which permitted them to make a windfall from insider trading. By 2014, one of these trades left an unclaimed gain of $2.5 million. This transaction was the result of put options that were placed on United Airlines stock. Since the planes involved in 9/11 belonged to United Airlines and American Airlines, the two companies took a major hit as a result of the attacks, with shares of United Airlines dropping from $30.82 to $17.50, and shares of American Airlines falling from $29.70 to $18. Put options are sold in blocks of 100 shares. They give investors the option of selling these shares at a future date at the price set when the options are issued. Thanks to these, the allowance of these transactions, investors could tie up 100,000 shares of United at $30.82 and 100,000 shares of American at $29.70, which the sellers were obliged to buy. When the prices plummeted respectively to $17.50 and $18 per share, the holders of the options could purchase the shares of the two airlines at the rock-bottom prices and immediately sell them at the price set when the options were purchased. The firm used to purchase the unclaimed gains in put options was Bankers Trust AB Brown, a division of Deutsche Bank, which remained under the control of the House of Rothschild. Bankers Trust, a New York bank, had been established in 1903 by J.P. Morgan. It merged in 1997 with Alex. Brown & Sons, an investment bank founded in 1800, to become Bankers Trust, A.B. Brown. Alvin Buzzy Krongard had been the chairman of Alex. Brown & Sons at the time of the merger. After the two banks combined, he became vice chairman of the new financial conglomerate. His task was to oversee private client relations, a position that brought him in contact with some of the world's richest people, including, allegedly, individuals involved in the heroin market, and the bank, according to Senator Carl Levin, became a major center for the laundering of drug money. After Bankers Trust A.B. Brown was sold to Deutsche Bank in 1999, Krongard joined the CIA, where he became the executive director. Few individuals had greater inside knowledge of covert operations and impending threats than Krongard, and fewer still had closer ties to the international banking community. On September 6, 2001, Bankers Trust A.B. Brown, where Krongard had served as a top executive, purchased 95% of the puts on United Airlines, and on September 10th, as part of the same investment strategy, 115,000 shares of American Airlines. Mystery number 5. The Visitor from Pakistan. And then there is the mysterious matter of General Mahmoud Ahmad, the head of Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI. 2 weeks after 9/11, the FBI confirmed in an interview with ABC News that Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of terrorists who hijacked the jetliners, had been financed from unnamed sources in Pakistan. Following this announcement, several European news agencies, including Agence France-Presse and the Times of India, were able to confirm that the money had been wired to Atta from Pakistan by ISI officials at the insistence of General Ahmad. Yet on the morning of 9/11, Ahmad, the alleged money man, was in Washington, D.C., conferring with top government officials, including CIA Director George Tenet. Senator Bob Graham, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator John Kyle, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Representative Porter Goss, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. After the attacks, Ahmad remained in Washington to meet with Secretary of State Colin Powell, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, Undersecretary of State Mark Grossman, and Senator Joe Biden, chairman of the Senate's Foreign Affairs Committee. The fact that the man who sponsored the terror attacks was rubbing elbows with America's leading political leaders before, during, and after the attacks should cause raised eyebrows from the most ardent supporters of the war on terror. Mystery number 6. The collapse of Building 7. A 47-story skyscraper located at 7 World Trade Center 1, New York City, was not struck by a jetliner. Yet it collapsed at 5:20 p.m. on 9/11 with little news coverage. The incident was not even mentioned in the official report from the 9/11 Commission. The building appeared to implode in the same manner as the Twin Towers. Yet officials from Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, argued that the collapse had been caused by fireballs of cascading debris from the towers. They asserted this argument even though no steel high-rise had ever before collapsed because of a fire. Adding to the mystery was the fact that BBC reported the collapse of the building 20 minutes before it fell to the ground. It took 8 years for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, to provide an explanation of why Building 7 was reduced to rubble. NIST insisted that the collapse was not caused by an explosion, since no audible sound of a blast could be detected on existing recordings of the event. Yet eyewitnesses, including members of the New York Fire Department, reported hearing sounds of explosives immediately before Building 7 collapsed. Mystery number 7. The search for Bin Laden. At 11 in the morning of 9/11, the Bush administration announced that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. This announcement was made without a police investigation, a statement of guilt by the leaders of Al-Qaeda, or any supporting evidence. At 9:30 p.m., the war on terror was officially launched against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The latter was singled out as being a state sponsor of the horrific events. 4 weeks later, on October 8th, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was launched. The American people were led to believe that the decision to go to war had been made on the spur of the moment without previous preparation. Since the central target was Osama bin Laden, the first casualty, as in every war, was truth. Bin Laden had been recruited by the CIA in December of 1979 to create a cadre of holy warriors, Mujahideen, to ward off the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. The agency provided the warriors training in guerrilla warfare and indoctrination in the tenets of radical Islam so that they would view the invasion as justification for holy war, or jihad. During the war in Kosovo, bin Laden and his holy warriors were used by the Clinton administration to combat the Christian Serbs in a struggle that was designed to safeguard the Balkan route by which heroin was transported from Turkey to northern Italy, and to establish the massive Camp Bondsteel military base to safeguard U.S. economic interests. Bin Laden became the world's most wanted man on November 4, 1998, when he was indicted in a U.S. federal court on 224 counts of murder for masterminding the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. A $5 million bounty was placed on his head by the U.S. State Department, and the leader of the Mujahideen became the favorite boogeyman of the press and the power elite. But the hunt was really a scam. 2 months before the events of 9/11, bin Laden was a patient at an American hospital in Dubai, where he was receiving treatment for a chronic kidney infection. During his stay in the hospital, the Al-Qaeda chieftain conferred with the CIA station head. On September 10, 2001, the day before the attacks, bin Laden was back in the hospital, this time in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, where he received dialysis treatments. This finding was substantiated by CBS News. The hospital in Pakistan was a military facility. It operated under the jurisdiction of the Pakistani Armed Forces, which had close links to the Pentagon. If this report is accurate, then bin Laden, in all likelihood, was still in the Rawalpindi hospital on the morning of 9/11. Despite awareness of bin Laden's whereabouts over the months before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, announced to the press that it would be difficult to find the Al-Qaeda chieftain and to extradite him.
"It's like searching for a needle in a haystack," Rumsfeld said.
When bin Laden was finally placed within a body bag by U.S. Navy SEALs, he had been living for 5 years next to an elite military academy in Abbottabad. The compound where Osama had been living with his four wives was not inconspicuous. It loomed over the Pakistani city like a strange mansion, and the world's most wanted man probably could have been collared by a Boy Scout troop.
38. War without end. The period extending from the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, to the present, is marked by a succession of U.S.-sponsored theater wars, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yugoslavia, various forms of military invention, including low-intensity conflicts, civil wars, the Congo, Angola, Somalia, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Sudan, military coups, U.S.-sponsored death squadrons, and massacres, Chile, Guatemala, Honduras, Argentina, Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, covert wars in support of Al-Qaeda, freedom fighters, Soviet-Afghan war, U.S.-NATO covert wars using Al-Qaeda as foot soldiers, Syria, U.S.-NATO-sponsored humanitarian military interventions, Libya in 2011, aerial bombings combined with support to Al-Qaeda rebels. The objective has not been to win in these wars, but in essence to destabilize these countries as nation-states, as well as impose a proxy government which acts on behalf of Western interests. Accounting for these various operations, the United States has attacked, directly or indirectly, some 44 countries in different regions of the developing world since 1945, a number of them many times.
Michelle Chosudovsky, The Globalization of War, 2015. Proof of the lifeless condition of Uncle Sam came with the avuncular figure's failure to respond to the mysterious circumstances surrounding 9/11 and the possibility that the country had been subjected to one of the most horrendous false flag attacks in human history. Such attacks had become commonplace. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein ordered a 500,000 Iraqi troops to invade and occupy Kuwait. The reason for the invasion was reasonable. Kuwait, while Iraq was locked up in a deadly war with Iran, had pilfered $2.4 billion in oil from the Rumdia oil field, an Iraqi oil field, and still Kuwaiti Emir Amir Jabir al-Ahmad refused to absolve even the interest on the Iraqis' debt to his country. This development posed no threat to U.S. national security, but it jeopardized the interests of the House of Rockefeller and the House of Rothschild, which feared that Hussein would invade Saudi Arabia and absorb the oil fields in the Persian Gulf. These two banking families controlled the world's largest oil companies, including Exxon and BP. They had created Saudi Aramco in the 1930s and remained the largest purchasers of Mideastern oil. This position enabled them to establish oil prices, a position that became threatened when Saddam Hussein's invading army appeared at the Saudi border. The Reagan administration, under the guidance of George Shultz and other CFR members, had sided with Iraq during the decade-long Iran-Iraq War. It had shelled out billions in agricultural credits and hundreds of millions of dollars in advanced weaponry to Saddam. The weapons were transported to Iraq by a circuitous route through Egypt and Saudi Arabia, since the House of Saud was also intent upon ending the reign of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. The United States, under Reagan, further equipped the Iraqi army with satellite intelligence, supplemented by AWACS, airborne warning and control systems, reconnaissance that could be used to direct weapons against Iranian suicide brigades. False flag number one. Saddam as baby killer. But when Saddam Hussein ventured into Kuwait, President George H. W. Bush, a prominent CFR member,
became intent upon launching a war against America's old ally. Bush's ties to big oil interests, including Standard Oil, were extensive. Early in his career, he made millions with the drilling of the first offshore oil well in Kuwait. He also became associated with the Carlyle Group, a leading defense contractor which numbered the Saudi royal family and the government of Kuwait among its customers. In this way, Bush Sr. was wired to the Rockefellers, the Saudis, and the military-industrial complex. Members of his cabinet were similarly wired. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, a CFR director, became the chief executive officer of Halliburton, and Secretary of State James Baker, another CFR member, became senior counselor of the Carlyle Group. The problem for Bush was how to justify U.S. military involvement against Iraq. Amir Jabir al-Ahmad al-Jabir al-Sabah, the Emir of Kuwait, was certainly not a sympathetic character. Stories were widely circulated about his profligate lifestyle. The Emir, according to unsubstantiated accounts, was syphilitic, kept 70 wives, and married a virgin every Thursday. The answer to the problem came with the raising of a false flag. Bush and his cabinet began to circulate stories that Hussein had ordered his soldiers to enter Kuwaiti hospitals in order to remove babies from incubators and to cast them on the floor to die. Repeating this concocted tale 5 times over the national airwaves, Bush said,
"I don't think that Adolf Hitler ever participated in anything of that nature."
The Persian Gulf War. On January 14, 1991, Bush Sr. launched the Persian Gulf War, which, as it turned out, wasn't much of a war. But it did allow the military-industrial complex, thanks to 24-hour television coverage on CNN, to showcase their latest technology in warfare: stealth bombers, cruise missiles, smart bombs, and laser guidance systems that pinpointed targets and minimized civilian casualties. Within a matter of days, the Iraqi Air Force was obliterated, along with airfields, missile sites, and communication centers. Throughout Iraq, most means of modern life were destroyed. All electrically operated installations ceased to function. Food could not be preserved. Water could not be purified. Sewage could not be pumped away. 9,000 homes were destroyed or damaged beyond repair. Following the war, economic sanctions were placed on Iraq, which resulted in a shortage of medical supplies and food. Malnutrition and disease increased at an alarming rate. By 1998, nearly 1 million Iraqis, mostly young children and the elderly, had died because of the embargo. Diseases that had been nearly eradicated reappeared, including polio, cholera, and typhoid. Cancer rates soared due to a proliferation of the uranium used in the smart bombs. In 1993, physicians discovered a new disease. Iraqi mothers, too malnourished to breastfeed and unable to buy powdered milk, began feeding their babies sugared water or tea. Almost all the babies died. The doctors called them sugar babies. Shortly after the Persian Gulf War began, Middle East Watch, a New York-based human rights organization, sent investigators to Iraq to verify the stories about Iraqi soldiers entering hospitals and removing infants from incubators. They were unable to locate any doctor, nurse, medical worker, or mother of a newly born child who could support the accounts that had caused the conflict. False flag number 2. The Kosovo massacres. Bush was not alone in raising a false flag to initiate a war in order to protect the interests of the CIA, the defense contractors, and the money cartel. In 1999, President Bill Clinton ordered the U.S. Air Force, under the auspices of NATO, to conduct a bombing campaign that reduced Kosovo to a mound of rubble. Between March 24th and June 10th, 37,465 missions were flown, destroying every stronghold of the Christian Serbs. The bombing was justified, Clinton and his administration argued, because the Serbs were committing genocide by murdering thousands of Muslim Albanians for the sake of ethnic cleansing. Since Kosovo was part of Yugoslavia, Clinton blamed Slobodan Milosevic for the alleged atrocities and compared the Yugoslavian president, much in the same manner that George H.W. Bush spoke of Saddam Hussein, to Adolf Hitler.
Though his ethnic cleansing is not the same as the ethnic extermination of the Holocaust, the two are related, both vicious, premeditated, systematic oppression fueled by religious and ethnic hatred.
Clinton told a group of 200 veterans of foreign wars members at the National Defense University at Fort McNair. Stories surfaced in the New York Times and the Washington Post about a massacre in the small village of Ratsak, where the bodies of Muslim Albanians were left to rot in the street. Investigative reporters from Le Figaro and Le Monde were dispatched to verify these accounts. They discovered that the bodies had been placed in unnatural positions, that the site of the massacre was completely devoid of cartridges, and that the villagers were unable to identify the victims. Another widely circulated story used to justify U.S. intervention concerned a mine in Trepka, where thousands of bodies of Muslim Albanians were allegedly dumped. In the wake of the war, a French gendarmerie spelunking team descended half a mile into the mine to the bottom in search of bodies. They found none. Some villagers said that the bodies were burned in a nearby furnace. A second French team inspected the ashes. They found no teeth, no bones, and no trace of human remains. Siding with the enemy. For aid in their struggle for independence, the Muslim Albanians turned to bin Laden and the Mujahideen. By 1995, more than 6,000 holy warriors from Chechnya, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia had made their way to the Balkans in preparation for the struggle against the Christian Serbs. Bin Laden visited the area three times between 1994 and 1996 to establish al-Qaeda training camps throughout the Balkans. He also shelled out $700 million to establish the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA. The purpose of this organization was to drive the Christian Serbs from Kosovo, to topple the government of Slobodan Milosevic, and to unite the Muslims of Kosovo, Macedonia, and Albania into the Islamic Republic of Greater Albania. President Clinton, along with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Secretary of Defense William Cohen, and CIA Director George Tenet, all CFR members, praised the KLA as freedom fighters. In no time at all, millions of U.S. dollars were flowing to the Muslim rebels in the form of military training and field advice. The United States was now in league with the terrorist group that was purportedly intent upon its destruction. History doesn't get any crazier than this. In the wake of the war, more than 200 Christian churches and monasteries in Kosovo were put to the torch. Accounts surfaced of the mass execution of Serbian farmers, the murders of scores of priests, and granny killings, the drowning of elderly women in bathtubs. Of the 200,000 Serbs who lived in Kosovo before the war, only 400 were left when the conflict came to an end. Hidden reasons for the war. After the Christians had been purged from Kosovo, the Pentagon established Camp Bondsteel on the border of Kosovo and Macedonia. This massive military base came to house over 6,000 U.S. troops. The purpose of the camp was to protect the Balkan route whereby heroin flowed from Afghanistan via Turkey to Western Europe. Another purpose of the 1,000-acre military installation was to provide protection for the Trans-Balkan pipeline, which was to channel Caspian Sea oil from the Bulgarian Black Sea port of Burgas to the Adriatic. The feasibility study for the pipeline had been drafted by the engineering division of Halliburton. And so the pattern persisted. False flag after false flag was unfurled to bring the United States into military conflict, while the American people, sapped of their strength and spirit, remained incapable of responding with cries of indignation, let alone outrage. America had become a corporation, and its citizens were not shareholders. False flag number 3. Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. In 2003, President George W. Bush and his CFR cabinet proclaimed that Saddam Hussein was now in league with al-Qaeda and planning an attack on American soil, that would eclipse the events of 9/11. Hussein, they maintained, had developed weapons of mass destruction that would soon be unleashed upon the hapless inhabitants of major U.S. cities. This false news was repeated over and over again on 532 separate occasions by Bush, Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. A sampling of their false statements is as follows. On August 26, 2002, in an address to the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Vice President Cheney said,
"Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us."
On September 8, 2002, Cheney appeared on Meet the Press and announced,
"We do know, with absolute certainty, that he, Saddam Hussein, is using his procurement system to acquire the equipment he needs in order to enrich uranium to build a nuclear weapon."
On September 19, 2002, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld told Congress that Saddam has amassed large clandestine stockpiles of chemical weapons, including VX, sarin, and mustard gas. On September 28, 2002, President Bush, in his weekly radio address to the nation, said,
"The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons, is rebuilding the facilities to make more, and according to the British government, could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes after the order is given. This regime is seeking a nuclear bomb, and with fissile material could build one within a year."
On March 16, 2003, Vice President Cheney appeared again on Meet the Press. This time he said,
"We believe he, Saddam Hussein, has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons."
On May 29, 2003, President Bush, in an interview with Polish TV, declared,
"We found the weapons of mass destruction. We found biological laboratories. You remember when Colin Powell stood up in front of the world and he said, 'Iraq has got laboratories, mobile labs to build biological weapons. They're illegal. They're against the United Nations resolutions. We've so far discovered two, and we'll find more weapons as time goes on. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them.'"
Blood for oil and natural gas. None of it was true. No weapons of mass destruction had been found. No plans to develop nuclear bombs had been made. No biological laboratories that were fabricating sinister germ warfare. The laboratories that Bush declared the U.S. invading forces had found turned out to be innocuous facilities that were manufacturing hydrogen for weather balloons. Despite the fact that Saddam Hussein was dragged from a hole, placed on trial before a kangaroo court, and lynched, no ties between the Iraqi ruler and al-Qaeda were ever substantiated. The war was launched to create a strategy of tension with Iraq. This allowed Anglo-American big oil companies under the control of the money cartel to seize Iraqi oil fields and to further their control over the world's supply of energy. Immediately after Bush announced "mission accomplished," ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP set up shop in Iraq, along with a slew of oil service companies, including Halliburton. Another purpose was to further the plans for the construction of a natural gas pipeline that would run from the North Pars, an Iranian port city on the Persian Gulf, to Damascus, Syria, via Iraq. Most European countries remained dependent upon Russia for its supply of natural gas. Therefore, the pipeline would serve to cripple Russia economically while furthering the interests of the House of Rockefeller and the House of Rothschild. Plans for the conquest and occupation of Iraq had been in the works for several years. In Winning Modern Wars, General Wesley Clark writes of meeting Pentagon officials shortly after 9/11 who said the military campaign included the invasion of 7 countries, beginning with Iraq, then Syria, Libya, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan. False flag number 4. Gaddafi as a mass murderer. In 2011, when Islamic extremists took up arms against the government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, the U.S. national news outlets, in tandem with the CFR administration of President Barack Obama, announced that the Libyan ruler was planning the mass murder of men, women, and children in Benghazi to cower the populace into submission. Therefore, Libya had to be bombed to smithereens for the sake of humanity. Justifying the bombing, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said,
"We had a murderous dictator threatening to massacre large numbers of the Libyan people. We had our closest allies in Europe burning up the phone lines, begging us to help them try to prevent what they saw as a mass genocide, in their words. And we had the Arabs standing by our side saying, 'We want you to help us deal with Gaddafi.'"
Unmasking mendacities. Of course, it wasn't true. On March 17, 2011, Gaddafi announced to the rebels in Benghazi, "Throw away your weapons, exactly like your brothers in Ajdabiya and other places did. They laid down their arms and they are safe. We never pursued them at all." Subsequent investigation revealed that when Gaddafi regime forces retook Ajdabiya in February 2011, they did not attack or kill any innocent civilians. The Libyan ruler also attempted to appease protesters in Benghazi with an offer of development aid before finally deploying troops in an attempt to end the rebellion. What's more, an Amnesty International investigation in June 2011 could not corroborate any allegation of mass human rights violations by Gaddafi regime troops. It rather uncovered evidence that rebels in Benghazi made false claims and manufactured evidence. The investigation concluded, "Western media coverage has, from the outset, presented a very one-sided view of the logic of events, portraying the protest movement as entirely peaceful and repeatedly suggesting that the regime's security forces were unaccountably massacring unarmed demonstrators who presented no security challenge." Siding with the Enemy, Part 2. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the organization of the rebels who opposed Gaddafi, was closely associated with al-Qaeda. Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama were well aware of this fact before they deployed bombers and troops to topple the Gaddafi government. A U.S. intelligence report issued months before the bombings contained this finding: "There is a close link between al-Qaeda, jihadi organizations, and the opposition in Libya." Oil-rich Libya was the most prosperous country in Africa. Education, medical treatment, and electricity were free, and gas sold for 42 cents a gallon. Women who gave birth were supported with cash grants, and couples with cash gifts from the government on their wedding day. Libya's state bank provided loans without interest and provided free startup capital to farmers. Gaddafi's crime against the money cartel. Gaddafi's independence from big oil and the money cartel was the cause of his demise. Earlier in life, Gaddafi's goal was to organize Arabs as a bloc that could withstand Western demands and depredations. He turned to Pan-Africanism and refused to join the U.S. Africa Command. Gaddafi also attempted to introduce a gold-based African currency that would free Africans from American financial hegemony. Gaddafi used Chinese energy companies to develop Libya's energy resources, thereby passing the interests of the Anglo-American big oil and banking establishments. The power elite, already upset with Russian presence in the Mediterranean, became faced with Chinese presence as well. Gaddafi was playing ball with the wrong people, and he had to go. On October 20, 2011, during the Battle of Sirte, Gaddafi was found hiding in a culvert by the rebel forces. He was beaten with rifle butts, sodomized with bayonets, and shot several times in the head. Upon receiving word of Gaddafi's demise, a gleeful Hillary Clinton said,
"We came, We saw he died.
An unanswered question. Is ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, a creation of the Obama administration, the CIA, and the U.S. State Department under Hillary Clinton? This question, which was raised by Donald Trump during his campaign for the White House, was dismissed as absurd by the national media. But evidence points to an affirmative answer. Gordon Duff, senior editor of Veterans Today, confirmed that the ISIS terrorists were trained in Jordan and Syria by U.S. Major General retired Paul E. Vallely and other senior military consultants. Vallely is a Fox News military analyst and the founder of the U.S. Army Psychological Warfare School. To establish his case, Duff has provided videos of Vallely and other American military officials with ISIS commandos. Support for this startling assertion was provided by Aaron Klein of WorldNet Daily, who unearthed evidence that the ISIS forces were and are trained at a secret U.S. military base in the Jordanian town of Safawi. This report has been corroborated by Der Spiegel, Germany's leading news magazine. Additional support came from Edward Snowden, the NSA National Security Agency whistleblower, who produced classified government documents that show that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, is a CIA operative. Muslim confirmation. Leaders from the Muslim world confirm these findings. Nabil Naim, the founder of the Islamic Democratic Party, who appeared on the pan-Arab TV station Al-Maidin to say that all current Al-Qaeda affiliates, including ISIS, work for the CIA. Mr. Naim could be imparting false information, but his claim is upheld by Baha al-Araji, Iraq's deputy prime minister, and other leading Iraqi officials. Mr. Araki is a devout Shia, and Mr. Naim is a militant Sunni. The two men share little in common and have completely different political and religious agendas. The covert purpose of ISIS. According to several news analysts, the purpose of ISIS is to create a state of endless war that will serve to exhaust Saudi and Iranian military resources, to bring about the dissolution of Syria and Iraq, and to collapse the Arab countries into small states that can be manipulated by the U.S.-dominated money cartel, which seeks control of their natural resources. This thesis is supported by classified CIA documents that affirm that arms for ISIS came, complements of the U.S., from the arsenal of Muammar Gaddafi. The shipment of these weapons to ISIS in Syria was supervised in 2012 by David Petraeus, the CIA director, who would soon resign when it was alleged that he was having an affair with his biographer. The Patriot Act. As a result of the endless wars without borders, the citizens of the United States became stripped of the liberties, once viewed as God-given, by the Patriot Act of 2001. No longer did they possess freedom of association. The government now could monitor religious and political institutions without suspecting criminal activity to assist terror investigation. No longer were they granted freedom of information. The government closed once public immigration hearings, secretly detained hundreds of people without charges, and encouraged bureaucrats to resist requests for the disclosure of public records. No longer did they possess freedom of speech. The government could prosecute librarians or keepers of any other records if they told anyone that the government was seeking information related to a terror investigation. No longer did they retain a right to legal representation. The government could monitor federal prison jailhouse conversations between attorneys and clients and deny lawyers to Americans accused of crimes. No longer were they free from unreasonable searches. Government could search and seize their belongings, including their personal papers, without probable cause for the sake of a terror investigation. And no longer were they granted the right to a speedy and public trial. The government could now jail anyone without a trial on charges of terrorism, including its own citizens. In the past, these rights characterized the citizens of the United States, who deemed them so precious that they were willing to die to sustain and uphold them.
but at the dawn of the 21st century they had surrendered them without a whimper. They were no longer Americans. They had become citizens of the world. 39. After the funeral.
There were periods like the Gilded Age in the 1890s and the Roaring Twenties, when a situation developed similar to this, but the current period is extreme. Because if you look at wealth distribution, the inequality mostly comes from super wealth. Literally, the top 0.1% are just super wealthy. This is the result of over 30 years of a shift in social and economic policy. If you check, you find that over the course of these years, the government policy has been modified against the will of the population to provide enormous benefits to the very rich. And for most of the population, the majority, real incomes have almost stagnated for over 30 years. The middle class, in that sense, that unique American sense, is under severe attack. A significant part of the American dream is class mobility. You're born poor, you work hard, you get rich. The idea that it is possible for everyone to get a decent job, buy a home, get a car, have their children go to school, it's all collapsed.
Noam Chomsky, Requiem for the American Dream, 2017. By the time Donald Trump ascended to the Oval Office, the brainstorm of Cecil Rhodes had transformed the world, but not quite as he intended. The New World Order did not result in the British flag flying over the earth with African aborigines, Afghan tribesmen, and Chinese clansmen communicating in English and dressed in dinner jackets. Nor was the world transformed and united by Englishmen who, aware of the white man's burden, had set out with the missionary zeal of Jesuits to colonize and inhabit the dark regions of the planet. And the great projects that Rhodes once envisioned, including the construction of the Cairo to Cape Town Railroad, never came to fruition. Rhodes was neither particularly prescient nor deeply insightful. His awareness of the breaking of nations before the forces of globalization was not unique. It had been discerned by many of his 19th-century predecessors, including John Ruskin, John Stuart Mill, and Karl Marx. The uniqueness of Rhodes resided in his insistence that the process of globalization could be controlled by a synarchy, an elite group of bankers, businessmen, and industrialists who meet in secret to chart global affairs. Contrary to Marx, Rhodes believed that the process of history, a process that Marx called dialectical materialism, would result not in the formation of the stateless state, but rather a socialist system in which the vast majority of mankind would become dependent upon big government to provide their basic needs. Outwardly, this government would be ruled by elected officials or strong-armed dictators, but inwardly, clandestinely, it would be controlled by an elite brotherhood. Among the original members of Rhodes's secret society, the most influential was Nathan Rothschild, who set up the House of Morgan to control the economic development of America. The Rothschilds would give rise to the Pilgrim Society in New York, a dining club within New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel that was off-limits to the general public. Within this rarefied setting, the wealthiest men in the country could meet to shape national policy. This group in turn would give rise to the American chapter of the Round Table movement. The House of Morgan served as the driving force behind the creation of the Federal Reserve System, which would control the country's money supply and the prevailing interest rate. This central bank was privately owned by representatives of the world's leading banking consortia, Morgan, Rockefeller, Rothschild, Warburg, and Kuhn Loeb. In The Creature from Jekyll Island, G. Edward Griffin points out, they, the banking families, were often competitors, and there is little doubt that there was considerable distrust between them and skillful maneuvering for favored position in any agreement. But they were driven together by one overriding desire to fight their common enemy. The enemy was competition. These families represented a classic cartel. A cartel, Griffin writes, is a group of independent businesses which join together to coordinate the production, pricing, or marketing of their members. In the case of the Federal Reserve, these elite families became joint shareholders who worked together to manipulate the U.S. and world economy. They possessed the ability to create depression or prosperity. They could print money ex nihilo out of nothing and lend it to the government with interest. In order for the interest to be repaid, the government was compelled to borrow more and more money from the central bank and to fall further and further into financial enslavement to the Fed's private shareholders. The banking cartel, under the leadership of the House of Morgan, manipulated events, including the sinking of the Lusitania, which brought America into World War I for the purpose of creating a global government. When this failed, the cartel set up the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Chatham House, in London, and the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, in New York. In time, the CFR came to preside over the affairs of the U.S. State Department. At the onset of the Great Depression, the interlocking interests of the cartel gave rise to the establishment of the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, where the banking families met in absolute secrecy. These meetings resulted in the creation of a covert economy based on real wealth, that is, gold. In keeping with this development, gold was hoarded and squirreled away in the vaults of the BIS. The gold standard was abolished, and the American government, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, confiscated the gold of its citizens, which they relinquished without cry or whimper. At the outbreak of World War II, the Rockefellers emerged as the dominant family within the cartel. Through the efforts of this family, the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization came into being. These organizations worked in tandem to dissolve the sovereignty of the United States. In his memoirs, David Rockefeller, founder of the Trilateral Commission and chairman of the Bilderberg Group, wrote, "Some even believe we, the Rockefeller family, are part of a secret cabal working against the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global, political, and economic structure. One world, if you like. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it." Rhodes's dream of a world unencumbered by tariffs or any barriers to free trade, thanks to the cartel, had become a reality. While labor remained stationary, capital moved. America's mighty manufacturing plants were relocated in the Third World, where workers were plentiful and willing to labor long hours for a pittance. Goods were no longer made in America, but in such places as China, Japan, Indonesia, Africa, the Philippines, and Mexico. As America lost its industrial base, its citizens became more and more dependent upon the government to meet their basic needs, including health care. Democracy, in accordance with the plan of Rhodes and his secret society, had dissolved into socialism. Due to the free circulation of labor and free trade between nations, labor supply far exceeded demand, and employment insecurity intensified throughout the United States. This was in keeping with the designs of the Federal Reserve and the money cartel. Testifying before the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs on February 26, 1997, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said, "An acceleration in nominal labor compensation, especially its wage component, became evident over the past year. But the rate of pay increase still was markedly less than historical relationships with labor market conditions would have predicted. Atypical restraint on compensation increases had been evident for a few years now, and appears to be mainly the consequence of greater worker insecurity. In 1991, at the bottom of the recession, a survey of workers at large firms by International Survey Research Corporation indicated that 25% feared being laid off. In 1996, despite the sharply lower unemployment rate and the tighter labor markets, The same survey organization found that 46% were fearful of a job layoff. The reluctance of workers to leave their jobs to seek other employment as the labor market tightened has provided further evidence of such concern, as has the tendency toward longer labor union contracts. For many decades, contracts rarely exceeded 3 years. Today, one can point to 5- and 6-year contracts, contracts that are commonly characterized by an emphasis on job security and that involve only modest wage increases. The low level of work stoppages of recent years also attests to concern about job security. Thus, the willingness of workers in recent years to trade off smaller increases in wages for greater job security seems to be reasonably well documented. American workers, once the most productive and well-paid labor force in the world, became forced to submit to the increasing demands of globalization and the money cartel. Their wages dwindled, their benefits all but vanished, and their working hours became extended. 2 adults in a family had to work, most in the service industry, to make ends meet. The cleft between the haves and have-nots grew to such an extent that the middle class disappeared into the widening fissure. Those who sought to advance from their insecure positions were advised to seek higher education, but the cost of tuition climbed to such an astronomical level that the average student graduated from college with over $100,000 in debt. This debt hung over their heads like a guillotine. It was a debt that couldn't be absolved by bankruptcy. Failure to make payments resulted in garnishments, even on Social Security checks. While the working class suffered and the infrastructure of America's cities fell into ruins, the money cartel continued to seize natural resources throughout the world in order to sustain their hegemony. Such seizures required conflict, and Americans by tens of thousands began to die in limited wars that were fought not for freedom, but economic interests of the chosen few. The same chosen few created the Central Intelligence Agency to topple governments hostile to their interest. These covert operations were funded almost solely by the sale of heroin. The heroin, cultivated and distributed under the auspices of the CIA, came from Southeast Asia, necessitating the Vietnam War, and then Afghanistan, necessitating the War on Terror. When the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan became precarious, the CIA worked with the Mexican drug cartels to develop poppy fields throughout the mountains of Mexico's west coast. By 2013, heroin and cocaine from Mexico, with a street value of $3 billion, flooded Chicago. The heroin arrived by land, rail, and air, including 747 jetliners. When Jesus Vicente Zambada Niebla, a member of the Sinaloa cartel, was collared by Chicago police officials, he claimed to be a CIA operative under government protection. His trial was halted by federal prosecutors on the basis of the Classified Information Procedures Act. The prosecutors claimed that Niebla's testimony would constitute a threat to national security. Heroin, by the turn of the 21st century, had become one of the world's most valuable resources, a resource that could generate over $100 trillion a year in revenue. The days when heroin money could be laundered through a small circle of banks, including the Vatican Bank, were long past. By 2014, $500 billion to $1 trillion in proceeds from criminal activity and black ops were laundered through the world's leading banks, half of which were located in the United States. Narco dollars became the lifeblood of the nation's economy. The U.S. banks developed an incredibly complex system for transferring illicit funds into the country for investments in real estate, corporations, industries, and government bonds. The financial institutions that participated in this process, according to Canadian commentator Assad Ismi, included the Bank of Boston, Republic National Bank of New York, Landmark First National Bank, the Great American Bank, People's Liberty Bank and Trust Company of Kentucky, Riggs National Bank of Washington, Citibank, and American Express International of Beverly Hills.
Manufacturers, Chase Manhattan, Chemical Bank, and Irving Trust have admitted not reporting transfers of substantial amounts of money to the U.S. government as required by the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, and the Bank of America has been fined $4.7 million for refusing to provide documentation for transfers of more than $12 billion. In an attempt to address this